All right, so last time as we finished our look at the introductory part of Hebrews, we explored possible dates, audience, and themes of the book. Now, regarding the dating of the book, as we discussed last time, it's hard to pinpoint an exact year because, as we already discussed, the author of the book is anonymous. This is made further difficult because within the book itself, there's no explicit reference to an historical event either. However, there are some subtle clues that perhaps point to at least a date of ranges, and we looked at that last time. First of all, we noticed and took a clue from the text that the author at least knew Timothy and was referring to his release from prison. Second, the author talks about the temple in Jerusalem as if it's still standing and conducting sacrifices. Now, if this is true, this would mean this would have predated the fall of Jerusalem in 70 AD. Also, another indicator is that the writer says in chapter 12 that this particular congregation, while having suffered some persecution, has not resisted sin, as he says, to the point of shedding blood. Now, this is important because as we looked at the audience of the book, this church was perhaps Roman. But further, we know that the intense and bloody persecutions of the Roman church did not start to occur until 65 AD when Nero directed his wrath against the Christians. But the dating cannot be any earlier than the mid to late 50s due to the fact that the author of Hebrews mentions both the fact that there are a second generation of Christians and that some Christian leaders have already passed on. So considering all these factors, a likely date range, we said, last time was between 60 and 65 AD, because this would allow for generations of Christians to pass, but would still predate the intense persecution of Nero and the fall of the temple in 70 AD. Now, we looked also at the genre last time. Now, this is the interesting part of Hebrews, one of the interesting parts, is because while it's been classified as an epistle or a letter, there are some notable stylistic differences between it and other epistles. Now, it has been proposed that instead of a letter, it was perhaps a sermon that was later transcribed. The reasons that we gave to that last time were, first of all, that the letter lacks any sort of traditional greeting or salutation, and goes right into a dramatic introduction about the supremacy of Christ. Again, as we'll look in here in a few minutes as we begin the text, it just goes into this long introduction about Christ himself. That would be an odd way to start a letter, wouldn't it? So obviously this seems to be maybe perhaps something that was spoken first. Now, second, the book takes the form of an exhortation. Now, as we mentioned last time, while letters, like especially the Pauline letters, can contain exhortations, this work is primarily an exhortation. Sermons are better known as mediums for exhortations, as we know, because of their focus is not so much in disseminating information, but in appealing to the heart. And that's what the author of Hebrews does. That is his concern for writing this to begin with. Third, there are little things that the writer says in the text itself that sound like someone is speaking. For example, the writer in chapter 9, verse 5, bemoans the fact that he doesn't have the time, can't speak in detail at this time, as opposed to talking about space, as you would expect to find in a letter. Now, you don't refer to running out of time in a letter, but you do if you're talking about something and you're preaching in a sermon or in a speech of some sort. And then we looked at the audience and purpose as well of the book. Now, while it's unknown about this local church, what we do know, the concerns of the local church to whom the author was writing. As the title of the book clearly indicates, the writer is writing to a Jewish church who is struggling. In fact, they're struggling so much that they're questioning whether or not to turn back to Judaism. But the writer in this exhortation is trying to encourage them to keep the faith by saying that the Christian faith, and more specifically, the person of Jesus Christ, is the fulfillment of the Jewish faith. So how does the writer show this to be the case? He does this by painstakingly going through the Old Testament in detail and describing events, laws and persons, and shows how they are met in the person and work of Jesus Christ. So his argument becomes, why go back to Judaism when it's all been fulfilled in Jesus Christ? It simply doesn't get better than Jesus. And lastly, we explored some of the major themes of the book. First, the writer contrasts between shadow and reality. Now, there are two distinctions that the writer makes. First, there is the ordinary conception of shadow versus reality. Now, if one considers what a shadow is, it's not that it's an inaccurate or inconsistent representation of the object that's reflecting, but it's rather, it's just incomplete. Shadows, we do know for a fact, accurately portray the shape of something, don't they? Right? As we can see here with the man. But what does the shadow lack? It lacks definition, right? Now, the term often associated with the Old Testament and what it does for the New Testament is that it prefigures the New Testament. That is, it announces or images something that will come later in fulfillment. Now, another way of looking at this relationship between the shadow and the reality is seeing them under the classification of type and antitype. Now, everything that came before Christ was merely a type. That is a general classification of a particular person, object, or idea. But after Christ came, he became the antitype or the better type. He became the fulfillment of that type. All those other things were just shadows. They were just prefiguring what was to come. There may be types of Christ before Jesus came. There were many types. That is, they imperfectly display the attributes of Christ that he would later exhibit. We know for a fact that Moses was a type of Christ. Joshua was a type of Christ. David was a type of Christ and many others. But the problem with what was with these types is that they were imperfect sinners, right? And they could not meet the requirements of the Messiah. But Christ not only demonstrated the feats and attributes of the previous times, but perfectly and exceeded them and surpassed them in every way. But also there's another distinction that the writer of Hebrews makes regarding the shadow and the reality. That is, there is a heavenly distinction made between shadow and reality. The Old Testament over and over again gives us images of heavenly realities that are prefigured from things down here. For example, the temple was representative of God's dwelling with his people. But what often gets missed is that in the Old Testament temple was a picture of heaven, for it was a reflection of the heavenly throne room of God. But we know the temple would be superseded with who? The coming of Jesus Christ, right? Who became the temple made flesh, or as the writer of Hebrews will later state, a more perfect tent. No longer would the temple be an earthly representation of heaven, but Jesus himself would be here. He would represent heaven embodied. And again, as we mentioned last time, what is the language of John in chapter 1? That he tabernacled with us, right? He dwelt among us. He tabernacled. Again, he is God's presence here on earth. Now, another theme that we looked at last time is the contrast between the old and the new covenant. Now, the language the writer of Hebrews uses is that the new covenant is a better covenant. But as we mentioned last time, we need to qualify what the writer means by a better covenant. It wasn't as if the old covenant was bad or half-baked, right? No, the old covenant was established as the means by which God's people would commune with him. So in that respect, it was good, right? God had established it. It was the means by which God would be able to fulfill meeting with his people. However, the point is that the old covenant was incomplete and insufficient. So this is telling us that once we consider the author's insistence that these Jewish Christians should not turn back to the blueprints, remember we looked at that last time, that's what was happening in the Old Testament. All of these images, all of these types and shadows were looking for, they were a blueprint of what would come in fulfillment in Jesus Christ, right? The fact is that he is the fulfillment of all these forms. He is superior to anything from the past. Just like you would say, a blueprint would be superseded by what? The house itself, right? The blueprint was just kind of showing what the house is going to look like. But you never mistake the blueprint for the house, do you? No. You're looking in anticipation of the house. Think about a new homeowner. As he's looking at that blueprint, he's getting really excited about what will be, but he knows it's not here yet. His excitement is going to be held off until he gets that house, right? And that's what the Old Testament people were going to do too. There is all this prefiguring, all this excitement building up with what would be. So that's why the writer goes in great pains to demonstrate why Jesus is the greatest high priest. He's greater than all the old prophets, and he is greater than the angels who represented God on earth. But it's also important to understand this as well. It's not as if these Old Testament categories have been done away with, but rather had been made better by the coming of Christ. God's method of salvation has never changed, has it? Just the way the means are manifested. That's the only difference. For example, the writer of Hebrews declares in chapter 7, verse 25, that Christ is our high priest, continually makes intercession for us, unlike the earthly priest, who were limited by physical limitations. And of course, mortality. Eventually they died, right? But with Christ, on the other hand, he is forever in heaven. He is eternal. He's constantly interceding on our behalf. Also, the term sons of Abraham for existence is still used by God's people in Paul in Galatians chapter 3. But now, instead of the term being relegated to just an ethnic group in Palestine, is now expanded to the whole entire earth. So it's made better, right? Also, too, in Colossians chapter 2, the Apostle Paul makes this equation that baptism is the new circumcision because it's now the new entrance into the covenant relationship with God. But it's better. Why? Because now it extends to both male and female, right? Circumcision was something that only the male members of the community were able to take part in. But now it is made better, has been expanded in the new covenant because now it expands to both male and female. Yeah.
Yeah, you know, Jordan, you're pointing this out, and the writer of Hebrews is showing us that by seeing Christ, knowing Christ, he is the fulfillment of all these things. It sheds light, his light, if you will, on those shadows so that we understand their place.
That's right.
They're prefiguring him. And I'm reminded of C.S. Lewis's quote. He's not referring to this concept, but it's a similar idea. He says, I believe in Christianity as I believe that the sun, S-U-N, that the sun has risen, not only because I see it, but because by it I see everything else.
That's right.
And
that's right.
Now knowing Christ and seeing the fulfillment of these things, it now he sheds his light.
That's right.
On these prefigures of himself and these purposes that God had happen through the Old Testament.
Well, and really, he is the key to unlocking the Old Testament. Think about some of the very obscure passages in the Old Testament. For example, to this day, Isaiah chapter 53 is perplexing to Jews. The suffering servant, they try to interpret it as if, and we'll talk about this later, but they see that Israel is the Son of God as a nation. And the suffering, so they're personifying, Isaiah is personifying the nation of Israel as that they are the ones who are suffering, right? And so, but they have no idea that was intentionally used of a, as we'll mention in a few moments, in Genesis chapter 3, verse 15, the seed of the woman, That's singular. That's not just a singular people. It's a singular person, right? And so Christ is the key to unlocking the Old Testament. And really, that's how it should be seen. And likewise, you're not going to understand what Christ had come to do unless you read the Old Testament, right? It's a two-way street. You can't just say, well, Christ is here, he has fulfilled the Old Testament, I don't even need to understand the Old Testament. No, you're not going to understand what he came to do unless you understand the context in which he came, right? And so it's God expects us to be able to assimilate both aspects into our thinking. And lastly, we looked at the writer of Hebrews in his exhortation gives warnings against falling away. And of course, we know this to be what is referred to as apostasy. Now, an apostate is not someone who's simply an unbeliever or even a rebellious Christian. No, an apostate is one who claimed the name of Christian, but left the faith. And here's the important part. They left the faith utterly and finally, never to return. That's an apostate. That's someone who was a part of the faith. And the writer, it's interesting, he will give six distinct warnings about apostasy to the Hebrew church in an effort to encourage them to remain steadfast in the faith. And as we mentioned last time, God uses means to keep people on the straight and narrow, doesn't he? As we're going to look at, these are going to be like warning signs that you see on a freeway. Don't veer off into the ditch, right? There's a ditch ahead. Beware, right? And this is kind of what kind of thought behind the writer of Hebrews. He's giving warning signs to God's people to be able to stay on the straight and narrow. And now, this week, we're actually going to begin looking at our passage. We're not going to get very far, as you're going to see. But again, there's so much to say, and I don't want to rush this. And so we're going to begin this evening. Now, I will begin by saying that this opening passage, I do want to read it in context, but we're not going to get to nearly everything in this passage. It'll be probably several weeks. But this is the opening passage, the dramatic opening passage in the book of Hebrews, verses 1 through 4. Long ago, at many times and in many ways, God spoke to our fathers by the prophets. But in these last days, he has spoken to us by his Son, whom he appointed the heir of all things, through whom also he created the world. He is the radiance of the glory of God in the exact imprint of his nature. And he upholds the universe by the word of his power. After making purifications for sins, he sat down at the right hand of the majesty on high, having become as much superior to angels as the name he has inherited is more excellent than theirs. Now, I want to kind of give you the broad picture, but now I want to condense it just to verse 1, because that's where we're going to spend most of our time this evening. Long ago, and at many times and in many ways, God spoke to our fathers by the prophets. Now, there's something that we need to understand as we begin. God has always spoken to his people, right? From the very beginning. It's not as if in the Old Testament, people were just kind of floating along aimlessly without God's guidance until Christ came. No, from the very beginning, God has been with his people. Yes, the fall of man did severely hinder that relationship, but God was always with them. Now, many times we have discussed what's referred to as the proto-evangelium, or the first proclamation of the gospel, where God promised that the seed of the woman, which is a singular person, would come and redeem them from their sins by crushing the head of the serpent. So this promise given to Adam right after the fall gives God's people hope. And again, as we're going to see, women from this generation onward, starting with Eve actually, are hoping that their child may be the one, the seed, who would come and bring them salvation. But during that waiting period, it was necessary for God to speak to his people in order to preserve them until the fullness of time had come, as Paul says. So prophets were sent to declare what God expected of his people and then rebuke them when they were disobedient to his commands. But also, God's people had to be encouraged and exhorted to continue in faithfulness. For in this waiting time, there were periods of great darkness when it seemed as if the Messiah would never come. However, these prophets were charged with admonishing his people that the promise made to them in the garden had not been withdrawn, and it was a certain reality. Now, as to the prophets themselves, this was indeed both a thankless and a dangerous job. Many of these chosen men did not live in luxury, nor did they enjoy notoriety. Now, often these men lived in poverty and obscurity, and trusting that God would sustain them, even when they couldn't see how they would be sustained, right? You looked at the prophet Elijah, who thought he was going to pass from hunger, right?
And Jordan, also, mm-hmm. The prophets were told that if they did not deliver the word of God, the things that they were to prophesy would occur to them.
Right, right.
Like curses would be on
that,
them.
That's right. And we're going to get to that specifically. But being a prophet was also a dangerous job for two reasons. First, the people were often not fans of the prophet's messages, were they? Because why? What did the prophets tell them? Did they tell them, oh, they're great and wonderful? No. Often they were sent because God wanted to point out their sin and demand repentance, right? That's why they were sent most of the time. Now, we know what happens when people are told messages they don't want to hear. Right? Often they become violent, right? Now, the writer of Hebrews describes what happened to the prophets. He says they were stoned, they were sawn in two, they were killed with the sword. So just imagine that on a job posting for a prophet. Was that something that you would take? Was that a job that you would take, right? No. Now, this is something that, again, people don't like being called out on their sin, right? And Jesus called out the Jews later on about this habitual practice. And what did he say to them? He said, "Woe to you, for you build the tombs of the prophets whom your fathers killed," right? Again, giving lip service, but yet your heart is the same heart that kills the prophets. And they would continue to reject the message that God had sent.
And in that passage, I think it's this mm-hmm. one. They literally conspire to want to kill him.
That's right. That's exactly right.
Of him telling them.
That's exactly right. They because who is the greatest prophet? It's Jesus Christ. He's coming. He is the culmination of every prophet's message. And so you just imagine the animosity that would be there naturally because they are their father, the devil, right? It's going to come out.
It's here now.
Yes, absolutely.
Christian, they hate you.
That's right. And we'll likewise with modern prophets and preachers, when they endure and when they are faithful, they can endure similar hostility, right? As we mentioned many, many times, as the saying goes, the problem with preachers today is that nobody wants to kill them, right? The fact of the matter is that if you preach the truth, if you don't put a human spin on it, it is detestable to the human mind, right? The unsaved, unregenerate human mind. They despise it. So when you have preachers like in Houston who fill a former basketball stadium and the world praises them, praises people like that, you begin to wonder, is this person a true prophet? Is he truly a messenger from God, or is he a false prophet, right? So those are things to consider. But here's the deal. The second aspect of things that prophets were afraid of was that it didn't stop with people, did it? For the prophets, angering God was found to be a more fearsome proposition. Again, I'd rather obey God than men, right, as Peter would later say. Because God, as Jesus said, is the one who can destroy body and soul, right? As opposed to just the man who can destroy the body. So who am I going to be more afraid of, right? I'm going to be more afraid of God, aren't I? I'm not going to be afraid of men because what can man do to me? He can take my body, but he cannot take my soul, right? Now, the word for prophet in Hebrew literally means mouthpiece. Now, Who were the prophets a mouthpiece for? Right? They were a mouthpiece for God himself. And so what this implies is that as mouthpieces, the prophets were a passive vessel who only delivered the exact message that God wanted them to deliver, right? In fact, this is what God tells Moses when he complains about speaking to Pharaoh. He seems to have had a speech impediment and feared that he would mess up the message. Well, guess what? Mankind, if left to himself, will mess up God's message, right? But God doesn't leave it to chance, does he? No, as he tells Moses, he says, "You shall speak to him, that is Aaron, and put the words in his mouth, and I will be your mouth and with his mouth, and will teach you both what to do." So this is the great comfort that we have as preachers, even modern prophets, that as long as we are faithful in delivering his message, he will be our mouthpiece, and it will be effectual despite our frailties and inabilities. So it's a two-way street, right? We faithfully present what God has told us to do, and he will bless it if we're faithful to his message and are simply mouthpieces for him, right? So this warning, though, is not given because the prophet may trip on his words or even unintentionally present the message ineffectively. But more so, this warning is that the prophets were not at liberty to tamper with God's message or change it in any way. For these are the very words of God himself. In fact, in Deuteronomy chapter 18, God gives this warning. "But the prophet who presumes to speak a word in my name that I have not commanded him to speak, or who speaks in the name of other gods, that same prophet shall die." The fact of the matter is, it's important to understand that God takes his word deadly serious, right? It is deadly serious. And the fact that apostasy is coming from lips of preachers and heresy today, think of the judgment that is waiting for them, right? Because they are not speaking on God's behalf. They are speaking words that he has not commanded them to speak. But what's also important is that during the Old Covenant, the time when God spoke through the prophets, God used many means to present his message to his people through the prophets. Sometimes God spoke to the prophets directly and gave them verbatim messages to proclaim, as he did with Moses and the Ten Commandments, right? That's verbatim. In fact, the idea is that God wrote on the tablets himself. And Moses, all he had to do was what? Read it. Right? Read it aloud. God gave the speech for him to recite, and he did it. He just read it verbatim. But at other times, he visited the prophets in dreams, like the prophet Zechariah, who received many visions. That'll be another interesting book to look at sometime. There's some very interesting visions and applications in the book of Zechariah and the vision of the horses. But then at other times, God would also have the prophets perform these bizarre sign acts that would act as proclamations of prophecy and against the people, like Ezekiel with his diorama of Jerusalem. The point is that God used many means as well as many parties in the Old Covenant in order to proclaim his will to the people. However, the writer of Hebrews then declares, "But in these last days, he has spoken to us by his Son." Now here, the writer gives a stark contrast between the way things were and the way they are now. In ages long ago, God spoke to his people using many means and many prophets over a long period of time. But now, the greater and final revelation of the Word of God has come to us, and has come to us through a single source, through the person of Jesus Christ. Now, this declaration is wonderful, but I first want to draw to your attention to how the writer declares the time in which his audience was living, in these last days. Now, I think the problem with the modern church's conception with last days is that we have classified the term wrongly. In our day, when we think of last days, we think of the rapture and the events that will forecast the imminent return of Christ on earth. Another way of saying it is that it's popular to see the last days in terms of quantity. We feverishly search the headlines to see if modern events will indicate when the last days are here. But the last days should not be viewed in terms of quantity, but of quality. In other words, the last days are defined as a specific time or age. And according to the writer of Hebrews, the first century church was living in the last days. So the question becomes, what is the biblical definition of the last days? Well, according to the writer, it's defined as the age in which the final and fullest revelation of God has come. This is further supported at Peter's sermon at Pentecost. You recall that? What does he say to them? Men of Judea and all who dwell in Jerusalem, let this be known to you and give ear to my words. For these people are not drunk, as you suppose, since it is only the third hour of the day. But this is what was uttered through the prophet Joel. And in the last days it shall be, God declares, that I will pour out my spirit on all flesh, and your sons and your daughters shall prophesy. So Joel was telling the people centuries ago that the last days would be known when the Spirit of God would descend upon the people and in mass would prophesy. And what was happening at Pentecost? Right. It was happening. So Peter's saying, guys, listen, the last days are here now, right? The Spirit has descended upon his people and they are prophesying. And it's not just coming from the lips of just a singular prophet, but from all of his people. It harkens back to, do you remember when Joshua came frantically to Moses and said that these two were prophesying, right? And he was frantic that he was going to somehow subvert Moses' position. And what did Moses say? Hey, don't stop him. He said, only if all of God's people would be able to prophesy. Well, guess what? This is what it was looking forward to, right? This event. It was looking forward to this event. And so this is what the point is. How was it that the Holy Spirit descended and came? Because of the final revelation of God, Jesus Christ had sent him. Right? So this means that we have been living in the last days for over 2,000 years, right?
I think one of the things that we noticed too was at the beginning, just going back just a little bit, mm-hmm. he mentions the fathers. Mm-hmm. That in first century Judaism, they would have known exactly who he's talking about.
Yeah.
It would have told them, you know, I'm talking about Moses, I'm talking about all of those. Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. That's who I'm talking about, you know. And that was where the Lord was speaking, and that same Lord who was speaking to them is now speaking now through his Son.
That's right.
But to use fathers was something that they would have all known exactly who they were talking about.
That's exactly right. And see, this is the context in which we have to, you know, kind of redefine again. We won't get into looking at the rapture in this class. I do not believe in a pre-trib rapture. That is a very fairly new doctrine that has not been believed probably the past 250 years. And you cannot find it in church believed in church history pre that period, the time of Darby and before that. Needless to say, it's a misunderstanding of what the term last days is. Again, Peter is defining for us what the last days is. The last days started 2,000 years ago. We have been in the last day. It's more an indication. Think of the last days like the church age. This is the age of the church. Christ advented. His first advent inaugurated the last days, right? We have been living in it. And as we will see later on, this notion of last days is something that, as Paul will describe, is like a pregnancy, right? What happens in a pregnancy? As it goes along, it starts off small, But then it continues to grow, and there's birth pains that become more intense and more intense and more intense. Until when? Until the child comes, right? And that's the idea that we have with the last days, is that it began 2,000 years ago, but as time goes along, there are birth pains. There are these ebbs and flows of intensity that continue to increase until the time that the church will be finally consummated. Again, what will be the indicator? We're not going to need to be looking at headlines. Christ will come, and that's it. That's the only thing that we should be looking for. He will descend, as the angels told the disciples in Luke. He will descend as he went up. That will be the indication of when the last day, or the end of the last days. Actually, that's when the end of the last days starts, is whenever Christ comes back. And he will come to judge both the living and the dead, right? Any other comments or questions this evening? Yeah, Lonnie?
You know, in these last days, he spoke to his my son, any preacher that would stand up and say, God has given me a new revelation.
That's right. There's no new revelation. Again, what does the writer of Jude say? This is the faith once for all delivered to the saints. It's it. It's it. There are there will be some, perhaps we may visit the warning in Revelation, which actually is a quotation from Deuteronomy, a warning not to add to God's word. Right? Not to take away or to add to it. Because why? It's settled. God, you are not free to create new revelation. You have not been given new revelation. Because the revelation has been completed in Jesus Christ. Yeah. Right? He is the final revelation, right?
Yeah, that's what I was going to add, is like you've read in the first few verses in Hebrews, where, you know, and he is the exact imprint of the Father. And as Christ said, he only speaks what the Father tells him to speak, and he does what the Father tells him to do. And so he's the express manifestation of the Father. And that's in its fullest form possible.
That's right.
Because it's in his Son.
That's right.
His sinless Son and a part of the Godhead. And so what other revelation could God give anybody else but through his Son?
That's exactly right.
To reveal himself.
That's right. He is the final revelation. He is, I mean, the buck stops with him. It really does. And that's something that, you know, I think, to Lonnie's point, I think the temptation is that we want something new, something novel, right? We're not satisfied with God's word. But see, neither were the Old Testament peoples, right? They were always looking for something new, something novel. That's why they delved into idolatry, right? They started, you start having, what, as soon as the northern and southern kingdoms split, what do you have? You have a mishmash between the faithful Jewish faith, and then you have mixed with Baal. You know, you have this hybrid religion that is invented because they wanted to distinguish themselves from the southern kingdom, but they were going to do it their way. They wanted something novel and new, something that would keep their people there in the northern kingdom and wouldn't feel like they needed to go to the south, to Jerusalem, to worship. And so this is not a new tendency, a new way of thinking, but we try to invent new ways, and we're not willing to just rest in what God has said,
yeah,
right?
It comes down to trust and faith.
Yes, absolutely.
That's been given to us. He's not going to give us, I mean, he can't. And he won't give us all of the reasoning of what he's purposing that will happen. We have to trust in him and the word that he has given to us.
That's exactly right. Through his Son, Lon.
I may have a king wrong, but wasn't it Jeroboam that set up two calves on each end of the
tree? Yes, it was Jeroboam. That's right. That's exactly right. And what does that unnamed prophet come and tells him that that altar that he set up is going to be, his bones are going to be burned on. It's going to be later desecrated. How is that fulfilled? When Josiah comes and he goes and desecrates that unholy altar that was set up, that place of idol worship. But if you think about it, when we try to invent new ways of worship, it's like that unholy altar too, isn't it? We desecrate God's name when we try to invent new ways to be able to worship him.
Jordan, it's different than Moses, you know, Ten Commandments coming down, obviously, the golden calf. Same principle.
You know,
Aaron builds an altar, you know.
That's exactly right.
Yeah, I mean, so history just continues to repeat.
Yeah, it's just in the way it manifests itself. It just looks different, but it's the same concept. It's the same reality, because as we mentioned last time, is that Aaron, whenever he builds the golden calf, he's not building another god. They call that Yahweh. They call that Yahweh, and that's the greatest of blasphemies, right? You know, it would have been more preferable had they worshipped a false idol and a false god, but they called that Yahweh, right? They called it Yahweh. So we have to be more mindful when we consider these things, right? So, Jake, did you have something else?
Yeah, I love the contrast of what happens at Sinai when the Lord speaks directly to the people and the mercy that he shows us by speaking to us through his son, right?
That's right.
You see the thunder, the cloud, you see the fire, you see the lightning. It's just a magnificent display of power. And then they hear the voice of God directly to them, and they're just afraid out of their minds, right? And they plead with Moses. Moses, you know, you go speak for us. Don't have the Lord speak to us any longer. Right?
That's right.
They're afraid. And then you see the mercy and the grace that Christ comes with. He's lowly. He's meek, but he's also, you see his power the same way. When they come to arrest him, and he says the name, and they just fall over.
That's right.
Yeah. So it's an amazing dichotomy there that you can look at and study forever.
Oh, absolutely.
It's just amazing, especially captured right there in verse number one.
Yes, absolutely. And again, that's why I wanted to start with that, that's why we didn't venture too far past that, is the fact that God has always spoken. God has always spoken, and it's always been good. That's another thing too. It's not just spoken, but his word has been sufficient, but now the fullness has come, the final revelation. And again, that's what the writer of Hebrews was doing. He's saying, guys, why are you going back to that?
Yeah.
We have the fullness. That was the blueprint. The house is here.
You never see in the Bible the person initiating.
Right.
The human initiating the contact. God is always coming down.
That's right.
He's always speaking.
He's always condescending.
Absolutely.
Actually, condescending. So next week, what we're going to begin, now that the writer has made that declaration, that now, in these last days, he's spoken to us by his son, now he's going to give justification of why that's true. Okay? He's going to list this long list of things of why Jesus is the final resurrection, why he needs to be worshipped, why he needs to be looked to. All these other things is because show in how he is the final word. And so the writer of Hebrews is going to go on this long list, and really this is going to springboard into the entire book, because the whole book is about the superiority of Jesus Christ, right? And so we're going to see this, and we're going to begin next week, Lord willing, looking at